This edition of Culture with Robert Bounds was first broadcast on the 16th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 114th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Well, we're still coming down from last week's tribute band Spectacular, but this week will not disappoint. Today we span five continents, embracing film, music, media, technology and everything in between. Prepare yourself for a cracking hour. We head to Brisbane, not with our English cricketing heads bowed in shame, but to the city's vibrant and fascinating film awards for Australasia, Asia, the region.
At some point, I think in the near or far future, we all realize that this region might be perhaps the most influential region in the world.
We head to Belgrade to see how the city's welcoming the international music circus. How does a former Soviet city reinvent itself as an essential stadium stop-off?
When, for example, Depeche Mode came and all of those people, I don't know how many thousands of them, it was like, oh, if after 10 years or something, we won for the first time.
Plus, we'll ask where one of the world's most well-known music websites is publishing a magazine and meet ex-Sonic Youth maestro Lee Ranaldo. A lot of good stuff, we believe, for you here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And we've got a little change to how we're doing the music this week. I wanted to play you some tracks from a record we couldn't reproduce live as a Midori House session, so I've selected a few cuts from DJ Tom Moulton's third Philly Regrooved series of wonderful, subtle reworkings of the golden age of Philly soul. My excuse is that all of Tom's remixes are out now as a big and beautiful to behold vinyl box set. The reworkings are longer than the original, so you'll hear a fade out at the end. How very 70s. First, here's his remix of New York City's I'm Doing Fine Now.
I'm doing fine now without you, baby. I'm doing fine now without you, baby. Remember the day you walked away.
That was I'm Doing Fine Now by New York City, rethought by Tom Moulton from his new release, Philly Regrooved 3, and more from that later on in the show. For a long time, the Australian city of Brisbane was only famous for its humid weather, rolling beaches, and a massive cricket ground. But over the last decade, it's hit a roll. Not only has Brisbane won the honour of hosting next year's G20 summit, it's also become the unlikely home of a major film event that some say even rivals the Oscars. The Asia Pacific Screen Awards are the highest accolade for filmmakers in the region, stretching between Egypt, Russia, Japan, and New Zealand. It's a catchment that includes a slew of fast-growing film industries, which together produce half of the world's movies. So who are the big winners during last week's awards, and how has this high-profile event washed up in sunny Brisbane? We sent Monocle's Adrian Craddock to find out more from the red carpet.
It was all done with a bit of fun, but some took it a bit to heart, which was unfortunate. It wasn't meant that way.
That's the voice of Graham Quirk, the Lord Mayor of Brisbane, Australia's third largest city. He's talking about some comments made by the famous English cricket player Kevin Peterson during a recent visit.
Kevin Peterson had made the comment that he'd rather watch paint dry than have a look around Brisbane. And so, I just suggested that, maybe the keys to the city but to the back door might be appropriate against that comment.
This unflattering image is something Brisbane is trying everything it can to remove. In 2009, it took on the tagline of Australia's New World City, fair to say to the smirks of those in Sydney and Melbourne. But fast forward to 2013 and Brisbane actually seems to be transforming.
One more over here. Thanks guys, here we go.
Who's celebrating her?
Lovely, thank you.
As I join my first red carpet media scrum, I feel like I could be in LA or Shanghai. In fact, I'm in front of Brisbane City Hall for one of its newest marquee events.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 7th Annual Asia Pacific Screen Awards.
Plenty of Australian cities talk about integrating themselves with Asia, but Brisbane seems to have an unrivaled determination. Last year, the city saw an opportunity when the Queensland State Government pulled its funding for the Asia Pacific Screen Awards, an event that's billed as the Oscars of the East. So, Brisbane poured $1.7 million into relocating the ASPAs from the Gold Coast to its City Hall.
I was immensely disappointed that the Queensland Government chose not to support APSA. Immensely disappointed.
Former journalist Des Power is widely credited with founding the Asia Pacific Film Awards 7 years ago.
This is a significant international cultural initiative. I'm delighted, obviously, that City Hall, the Lord Mayor and his fellow councillors are now supporting it. They've kept it alive. They've given it a future. I'm often asked that question, why Brisbane, why Australia? And really, it is quite simple. Well, we thought of it first, and here we are. So, in years to come, when I'm no longer here, I think we'll be right up there and regarded as a hugely significant event for the film industry.
It seems like the APSAs are already on their way. The Hollywood Reporter and Variety magazine both show a keen interest in the award. It has backing from UNESCO and is increasingly attracting world-class talent.
I think it's a great idea that it's done in a country that is probably most neutral.
That's the Singaporean director Anthony Chen, the winner of this year's APSA for Achievement in Directing.
You can call me Terry, ma'am.
This is your bed. Sleep here.
Terry, give me your passport.
Anthony's a big deal. His film Illo Illo is about a family and they're made in the midst of the 1997 Asian financial crisis. It took out this year's Camera d'Or at Cannes, which is the award for the best first feature.
Any other country hosting it, whether it's China or Japan or Taiwan for that matter, you know, it would start sounding political.
Anthony also makes the point that Australian audiences are best suited to an event like APSA.
For many parts of Asia, the audience taste, you know, they tend to go for very brash, very slapstick, very in-your-face comedy. And my sense is that the Australian public and the Australian audience, they have developed a little bit more sophistication in their taste. And interestingly, we almost place judgment the moment we say, oh, there's something new happening in the Asia-Pacific region. It's almost like it's always the new baby. It's always pubescent, it's always developing. But at some point, I think, in the near or far future, we all realize that this region might be perhaps the most influential region in the world.
Even though they're billed as the most prestigious film award in Asia, the APSAs compete with some far more established ceremonies. Just a few months ago, Anthony won 2 Golden Horse Awards in Taiwan. But as he pointed out, those awards are just for Chinese-speaking films. The great ambition in Brisbane's event is trying to judge the quality of a group of films in such a variety of languages, cultures, and cinematic styles. It's a challenge for the international jury, but Australian actor Aaron Peterson seems to get a kick out of it.
It feels like a bit like the World Cup. It's fantastic, yeah. Actually, yeah. I'm representing Australia, but I say go Alice Springs.
Aaron was nominated for Best Actor for his role as an Indigenous detective in the Outback Whodunit, Mystery Road.
So much for your step, J-boy. Those big boots of yours will get you in trouble, won't get you in trouble.
Let's face it, you know, there's more that goes on in the world than what goes on in our own backyard. You know, we've got to get out of this mentality of being inward-looking. We have to believe that, you know, Australia is such a multicultural country now. We're a hybrid nation made of so many nations. But, you know, the stories are all similar. I think the great thing about filmmaking is people are people no matter how they look. You know, we're all pages from the same book.
It's a view shared by Brisbane's Lord Mayor, who's doing well to position Brisbane as Asia's gateway to Australia. He may not have the benefit of Perth's beaches, Sydney's architecture or Melbourne's cafes, but what he does have are open arms.
I often get some people say to me, you know, Graham, what does Brisbane want to be famous for? And that's a difficult question because we don't have an opera house or things like that, structural things here. But what we have is people that are friendly and caring, and I think these events help to identify us. We want to be a city built around relationships.
It seems the Lord Mayor will have every chance to showcase this asset over his term. The APSAs are confirmed to stay in the city for 3 more years. And more importantly, the G20 summit arrives next November. The question is whether Brisbane's enthusiasm to be Australia's new world city will remain once the diplomats and movie stars return home. For Monocle in Brisbane, I'm Adrian Craddock.
You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're back next to ask how a nation puts itself on the music map.
The Czech Republic has a rich toy-making history which dedicated collectors and craftsmen are struggling to keep alive. From atelier to Christmas market, Monocle Films discovers an inspiring toy story where art meets craft.
I love to keep the craft going. So that's what I'm trying, to keep good quality, clever ideas, put them in a wood. Wood is wonderful material, and I'm fully respecting wood. You can see the raw wood, unpainted, natural wood, so you can enjoy the color and shapes and grains and have a joy from that.
A Bohemian Toy Story, premiering in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we move seamlessly now to the music scene of the former Soviet Union. For a long time, Belgrade was well and truly off the rock and roll map. Serbia's capital went through conflict and international embargoes in the 90s, and economic woes followed in the new millennium. All a real blow to people who'd grown up with Western music, thanks to Yugoslavia's enthusiastic embrace of sounds banned in other communist countries. But now the bands are coming back to Belgrade with a vengeance. In the past year, arena fillers like Beyoncé, Depeche Mode and Peter Gabriel have made their first visits. And smaller venues have been hosting the likes of Lloyd Cole, Public Image Limited and Mark Lanegan. Now the government is hoping to use music to attract more international visitors to Serbia and change the country's image for the better. So how does a nation go about putting itself back on the touring map? Monocle's Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay has been facing the music.
For decades, if you lived in Belgrade, this was about as close as you could get to hearing Peter Gabriel play live. A concert album that came out 30 years ago is no substitute for the real thing, but since the breakup of Yugoslavia, the musically inclined citizens of Belgrade have become used to slim pickings. Major acts struck Serbia's capital off their schedules as international embargoes and economic woes took their toll. But in the past year or so, things have started to change, and Peter Gabriel was just one of the big names who played their first shows in post-breakup Belgrade.
Promoters will only put things on if they think they can make some money at it, and artists will then come so that they can make a bit of money too.
David Rhodes has been playing guitar with Peter Gabriel for more than 3 decades.
In this case, Peter's management, he'll look at the map and the gigs that he knows we can get, Milan, Vienna, whatever, and then he'll go, well, perhaps we could head down into Serbia or Croatia or whatever. And so then he'll look for offers from those territories. And if the offers work out, if the promoters feel that they can make it work, then artists will add that territory to the circuit.
I am John, and I was born in London. I am no vulture, this is my culture.
John Lydon's Public Image Limited were among the other visitors in what turned out to be a bumper year for Belgrade's gig-goers. There was pop glamour as Beyoncé opened her world tour here, industrial gloom as Depeche Mode played an enormous outdoor show, and Green Day stayed out of rehab long enough to rock out at the foot of Belgrade's ancient Riverside Fortress. So why are all these high-profile visitors putting Belgrade back on the international musical map? David Rhodes admits the changing economics of the music industry may have had an influence on the influx.
If you're not doing shows, you're losing money, and a lot.
Are you finding yourself as a working musician now playing not just
playing
in,
more
and in new in different places?
Yes, and I think that generally artists will be pushing further east every year. But then there's the problem of lower ticket prices as you move east.
You only have to stroll down Belgrade's main pedestrian drag to see how much music means to people here. There are posters plastered on every available surface advertising upcoming gigs. There's everyone from dance DJ Dave Clark to rock dinosaurs Deep Purple, plus a plethora of local acts. So it's easy to imagine how frustrating it was to live through the years when the city was off limits to international tours.
When, for example, Depeche Mode came and all of those people, I don't know how many thousands of them, it was like, oh, if after 10 years or something, we won for the first time.
Valentina Matsura organised Belgrade's Parallel Festival, and she's got a prescription for making sure the city continues on its musical upswing.
Better conditions from our country and government for us who are organising those artists. I suppose it would be very important to look at pop culture at the other way, because if you don't invest in culture and pop culture, you won't have products from it, and also you won't have successful artists coming.
I don't mind the flowers and the trees. I don't mind the birds and I don't mind the bees.
Valentina's efforts were certainly appreciated by Lloyd Cole. The British singer-songwriter's sell-out gig at the Parallel Festival marked the first time he'd played in the Balkans.
This is the only concert that I'm playing this year in a city that I haven't been to before. There's a whole block of the world that starts somewhere close to where the old Iron Curtain used to be and goes all the way to Japan that I've almost never been. And from a selfish point of view, I'd be excited to try and go to new places. I mean, I'm certainly, you know, I'm not Peter Gabriel.
Quite apart from helping out hard-up artists, there's a growing realisation here that music could play a part in Serbia's rebranding as it moves from isolation towards membership of the European Union. The Exit Festival in Novi Sad has been pulling in the punters for years, but attracting international visitors to gigs in the capital could have an even bigger impact. Cultural diplomacy could go a long way to improving the country's image, and Prime Minister Ivica Dačić says his government wants to make it easier and more attractive for big-name acts to come here.
Well, I think that it all greatly contributes to strengthening the position of our country, and a huge number of people from abroad, foreigners, who come here, who can see for themselves the way of living we are living here and the mentality of our people. So the huge number of them comes to love our people.
And if any further encouragement were needed, it's worth pointing out that ticket prices remain extremely reasonable in Belgrade, about €13 to see Lloyd Cole and €30 for Peter Gabriel's live spectacular. The beer's cheap too, everything you need for a European gig weekend, in fact. But don't tell everyone, okay? For Monocle, in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Thank you, Guy, and you're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Pictures never lie, right? Well, sorry to disappoint you. A fascinating new show called Lieu de Mémoire, from a quote by French historian Pierre Nora at London's Sumaria Lunn Gallery, takes a critical look through a glass, darkly, at representations of reality, history and the news. It's a group show, but I focused on the work of British artist David Birkin, whose pictures, blown-up reproductions of newspaper photographs of some of the key players of late 20th century politics. And here's the rub. These are pictures with the newspaper photo editor's marks on them. Crop this out, delete the background, move these people closer, darken this man's eyebrows. In short, doctor the images that became part of the Western world's understanding of the Middle East, for example, or the Soviet Union. I was given a tour by the gallery's co-director, Will Lunn.
Getting into what you're seeing standing here, these are massively blown up to standard movie poster size. Little images that are pre-edited photographs from newspapers.
So these are the crop marks that would have been used in an original newspaper layout, right?
Yes, I mean, this is something that I've found contemporary viewers are finding quite hard to process, because we now live in a Photoshop age where if you wanted to see what the Vogue model looked like before she ended up on the page, you'd have a lot of difficulty. There is no prior evidence quite often of what mediations and changes have been made. At this point, newspaper editors, picture editors, are having people bring physical reels of film to them, and they are drawing on them. I mean, this is covered in watercolor and pencil, all sorts of little annotations and marks that are then going to be taken into the darkroom and made real. And I think this is where we get into what this, the core of this series is about. Blowing them up makes it even more clear just how much these have been changed and manipulated.
And I mean, the crop marks are a fascinating thing, aren't they? We've got, for example, it's close up on a man's face. Maybe you lose some of the body language, you lose the background, you lose the reactions of the faces of the people around them to presumably make icons out of these people, right?
I mean, interestingly, the series is called Iconographies, and for David it was quite interesting to look at the fact that these are both icons as people, but also that all these crop marks and little annotations, for example, here we have these little crosses on the President of Nixon piece and the word route. This is a visual language of the editor to say, well, let's cut this stuff out here and in this certain way and maybe with a certain fade. So these are iconographies, little languages for how these are to be edited. But this is actually a really nice opportunity to talk about some of the details that maybe some people miss when looking at these. Clearly, a lot of them have been cropped down and certain elements have been cut out. But you've got, in the way that David Birkin has set them up here, quite defined two teams. And you can really see that one team, shall we say, of the Cold War generation is being vilified, and the other is maybe being shed in quite a positive light. But I want to just draw your attention to this Yasser Arafat.
Yeah, let's have a look at Yasser. What do you think was the intention of the photo editor with this picture? He's holding a woman's hand. She looks thrilled to be touching the hem of his garment, I suppose.
I mean, I think this is quite interesting. Well, I'm going to talk about what edits have been made, and I think it will become quite clear what the intention is here. So, as you say, there's this really delighted woman shaking hands with a young Yasser Arafat, who's looking quite upbeat about the situation. They're having a nice time. It's been cropped down so that this interaction, this perfectly normal interaction with this lady, is completely removed. So instead you have a sort of grinning figure with no context. But then we get into much more major edits. You can see here defined brush marks where his upper lip has been adorned with a quite heavy, quite severe moustache. This is where things, I found this unbelievable when I first saw it. The photograph has been edited in watercolour to give him gappy teeth. They've defined his lips, so they're much bigger and much darker. These, of course, look comical here, now I've pointed them out to you, but in the darkroom, these will be spliced with original photographs to become quite convincing.
This is original stuff. This is what happened in the photo editor's lab, or whatever.
Yes, I mean, these are completely unedited. What David has done is to spend a huge amount of time finding these, getting access to them. He's at a residency at the Whitney at the moment. These are from a New York newspaper archive. They were hard to even find the existence of, let alone whittle down, find access to, get permission to use these photographs. These are from a vast archive, and so the selection is very important. But the image itself is expanded and blown up, but it's otherwise a faithful representation of that original. So we can say, I mean, this David himself has not painted in the lips. This was the photo editor. And I think the key thing here really is that you're going to end up, well, you can see quite clearly that Arafat, there's so many changes to this Arafat one. You know, the glasses are extended to make this weird angle at the edge, a kind of pair of 50s women's glasses. The background's much darker. This orange spot here refers to a very strong light. What you're going to end up here at the end is a kind of Nosferatu figure. You know, this is someone that's going to be looking really quite insane. So this is probably the heaviest edit in terms of vilifying someone of the whole set. I just think it's completely amazing, really.
If Yasser Arafat might be being made out to be a baddie on this team or on the other team, Who might we consider is getting a healthy edit? Kissinger looks like he's wearing a sort of Caesar-like toga or something here.
I think, I mean, you picked an interesting example. Everyone to the left of Nixon is looking pretty good, yeah. But a lot of them are quite, they're looking good and they're just quite well-taken photographs, neatly cropped. There aren't these heavy edits that the others are getting. However, Kissinger is getting this amazing makeover. There is a fairly simple crop, no major edits. They're not going to sort of brush his teeth white or anything, but they're going to give him a Caesar-like robe. They're going to align him with all of the positive associations of power, of civilization, with this ancient Greek, Greco-Roman tradition. And this is something that's really bound up with Western politics. The White House is white, and it's surrounded by large Corinthian columns. It's aligning back to this idea of Athens being a sort of starting point of Western civilization. So here Kissinger is getting this immensely noble pose, and it's going to legitimize him, what he's doing, and his power. I think it's interesting that they've chosen to do this in such a way that you're going to see it's a clear manipulation. And that's what's really key here. Here you're going to know that they've done this, and you're going to read that in a certain way. Whereas in these other photographs, the edits will be imperceptible. I mean, that's what's quite key here. In this exhibition, this series, above all else, is talking about the reality of history and memory.
Mm-hmm. There's also a strange element of sort of pop art, Richard Hamilton, about these. The messing around with the image, the watercolor wash, the annotations. There's that level. There's the kind of fact that they are beautiful, kind of striking images, with, as we talked about, these editors' notes in orange crayon that really pop, like a bit of pop art, right?
I think, I mean, that's a very interesting point to draw out as well. We've talked about a lot of quite heavy political messages and levels and layers of connection here, but they're also very immediate works. You walk in and they're striking. David has picked this movie poster format. And actually also a frame that relates directly to that. This is what you see when you walk through the cinema and they're advertising their next film. This is an iconic sort of but personable size. And like you say, these bright orange annotations just serve all the more to draw your attention to what are already iconic figures in iconic photographs. So I think they draw you in and people start to decode them, which I think is very important for what is a complex work. Is for it to be really quite approachable as well at another level, and to want you to get you to want to access the rest of it.
That was Will Lunn of the Samaria Lunn Gallery in London. The show is Lieu de Mémoire, and it's on until the 24th of January, and I definitely recommend a look. Still to come in part two, we'll be finding out about music blog Pitchfork's move into print. We'll meet the team attempting to archive the entire internet and get a taste of ex-Sonic youther Lee Ronaldo's latest project. Time for a song now, another track from our album this week, Tom Moulton's Philly Regrooved 3. Rethinking classics? It ain't heresy, as you'll see. Here are the Spinners with Could It Be I'm Falling In Love With A Difference. Tom Moulton remixing The Spinners there. One more from that great, great record, Philly Regrooved, at the end of the show. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now we turn to what you might think is a bit of reverse engineering in the media. Pitchfork.com has for 15 years, been the cream of the crop of music blogs. Only now it's not a blog, but a wealthy and luxuriant resource of reviews, articles and breaking tracks. And now it's become a magazine. Last week saw the publication of the Pitchfork Review, the first in a quarterly collection from the Chicago-based Musos. I spoke to Pitchfork's president, Christopher Caskey, about 20 minutes after he opened his first batch of issues as they came back from the printers.
We're really proud of what we've been doing online for the last 15 years, and that will continue on forever as far as we're concerned. But at the same time, we're all romantic people that value and we're inspired by print early on and still look to print for a variety of things, whether it be design inspiration or content inspiration or whatever. And having something that you can hold in your hand was important for us to include as a part of what, you know, a legacy might be, for so to speak, and what we could maybe add to the world of that ideal, of the collecting ideal, where, you know, something that you can put on your bookshelf is really what is of matter, you know. So much like a record, you have a record collection, and people have book collections and art collections, and we'd like to contribute to that. So we wanted to take our time and figure out where we could fill in the blanks there, and I think we've done it.
There's a sense when you look through your old back issues, maybe in the UK of Q or something like that, or the NME, and you look back through things, there's a sort of pleasure in seeing, obviously, the people that turned out to be great recording artists, but also the people that kind of slipped through the net, the quality net. Obviously, Pitchfork's got a different vibe to that. There's a lot of cutting-edge stuff on the website. Do you like to go back and kind of see the ones that got away, that sort of slipped through the net? I mean, I guess the magazine will be doing something different to that and trying to sort of present a review of an era, almost.
The range of content is less about being of the now and more about, you know, a snapshot of where our heads are at of the now, that also will feel like it will be as relevant down the line. So I don't know that it'll be the type of thing you can pick up in 15 years and say, oh, look, we just saw this band was here, or we missed this band. But on Pitchfork, of course, I mean, you look at the way our goal is we're all most inspired by kind of new and emerging music. As much as there's a bunch of great, you know, established musicians and artists putting out great things, we're music dorks, and we'd love to find something new and are excited by that. So I'd like to think that we haven't missed too much, but at the same time, the internet moves quickly, and things are, you can click off things very quickly, and you can delete MP3s very easily. So there's definitely kind of a disheartening feel with regards to trying to redefine what it means to be a publication online right now, and looking at music and everything and seeing things and how fast things move. And the review is definitely a statement that is to say, you know, in the same way that we do a music festival, let's create a moment in time and come for 3 days, and where the festival might create memories, at the same time it reflects the ideals of what Pitchfork does on a day-to-day basis. And the review will do the same thing in a more permanent fixture that you can hold, obviously.
In terms of the layout, the design, and staffing it, in terms of the general sort of atmosphere, music is quite different, I presume, to the Pitchfork website. What was sort of surprising to you guys when you were putting it together? I guess, I mean, there's different sort of speeds of reading and a different way that a page is laid out, clearly, for those two different disciplines, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, our creative director, he worked in print for a long time, long been inspired by print, and he and I have long since talked about doing this. So it's been kind of a dream come true. But, you know, as the web has expanded in terms of the technology available to us to create good things, it really, where it once felt very confining with what we could do, we feel like we can kind of do anything now and reinvent the way in which people read content like Pitchfork online. And whereas before we were kind of just these little punks on the internet, now we're what we'd like to at least think we are. We're kind of in the driver or passenger seat with regards to redefining that experience for people online. So, you know, like I said earlier, a lot of that is inspired by very basic fundamental design and structure components that come from print. So it really was more, one of the biggest surprises was how natural it was to think about putting something that we're used to doing digitally into a print format, you know. So at the same time, being indulgent and focusing on paper stock and focusing on a variety of imagery and a variety of, I mean, everything from top to bottom, it didn't feel indulgent in the negative sense of that word. It just felt like we really dove in and wanted to do something that was inspired by good things that exist, you know, but also that was our own spin on that, and that celebrated the cool things you can do with print.
And just finally, Christopher, are we seeing a little bit of a golden age of the sort of return of physical? I mean, this in terms of vinyl being sold, in terms of physical record stores, at least the independent and interesting ones aren't making a resurgence. And you guys turning a website into a magazine, I don't mean that exactly, but you know what I mean, turning a website brand name into a magazine. There's a little bit of a golden age, maybe a purple patch for physical here right now.
I think so, and it really comes down to that kind of romantic idea of collecting, and I have a record collection in my house that I have spent years cultivating, and that was cultivated because not only do I love music and music's omnipresent in my life, but I also want to have something that I can pass on to my children as I grow older, and like it reflects who I am and what my interests were as far as music's concerned, and that's very important to me, and that kind of goes into supporting artists that are creating this art and making things feel you know, like a year and a half a band spends putting a record together, that even though it might be come and go from the internet in 3 weeks, at the same time it means something. And so print's the same thing. It's I think the era of getting your monthly or weekly magazine that's you can look at and look through 100 pages of ads and flip through and then throw away, that's dying, and I think it's important that dies. But the resurgence is coming from places that are very focused and that know exactly what their audience looks like and are delivering something to their audience that speaks. It's not trying to be everything to everybody. It's trying to be just a specific thing for a group of people that care about it. And for us, not everyone that reads Pitchfork is going to, you know, subscribe to the Pitchfork Review. We're only going to be printing 10,000 of them. It's going to be very small in comparison. But that's by design. I mean, not every single person who listens to music buys vinyl. But there is a portion of people that are both young and old. I don't think it necessarily is tied to age any longer. It's tied to an ideal. And being a part of that will continue to be important for us. And I think that it's good for print.
And that was Christopher Caskey talking to me from Chicago as he just opened his first box of Pitchfork Reviews. And the pitchforkreview.com has all the details. Maybe you want to subscribe to that. Coming up next, we're going to speak to ex-Sonic youther Lee Ranaldo. Stay tuned.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. After over 30 years as an integral part of noisy US art rockers Sonic Youth, now on hiatus, guitarist and singer Lee Ranaldo has a new band. They're called The Dust and have a new album in tow, Last Night on Earth, which sees him continuing the reflective mood of 2012's solo outing, Between the Times and the Tides. Well, Tom Hall went to see them for himself and caught up with Lee at a recent show.
The new record is called Last Night on Earth. But I wondered, what were you doing last night on Earth?
This last night? Last night we were playing a show in Lille in France on the Belgian border. It was one of the best shows we've played, I think. Like, you know, just full stop. Someone in 2010 invited me to play an acoustic solo show in the south of France, and I kind of resisted for a long time because it had been 20 years since I'd played an acoustic guitar in public. And while I was preparing for that show, I thought I would just play some cover songs and some acoustic versions of some Sonic Youth songs. And a new song popped out that was a song from the Between the Times and the Tides record called Lost. And something about the process really reaffirmed this magical quality of songwriting to me. I was like, this song didn't exist, and then one day it popped into being, and 2 weeks later I was in front of 1,000 people in a town in France playing it on stage. And some of them have become kind of delicate ballads, which maybe is an unusual thing, or you have to be pretty comfortable with what you're doing to do those kind of songs and to let them put them across in a slower pace where people are expecting you to be furiously rocking out all the time.
The recent album, I've heard people attributing that to a kind of environmental concern, maybe. Is that people reading into things too much, or do you have kind of issues that you're trying to address at all with this album or just in life in general like that?
I mean, I think at some point I let the cat out of the bag that a few of the songs were started during the week after Hurricane Sandy hit New York, which was just a little bit over a year ago, almost exactly a year ago now. And, you know, where we live in Lower Manhattan, we weren't flooded out, luckily, but we lost lights and heat and power and electricity and everything for about a week, 7 or 8 days. And there wasn't much to do in the evenings. You know, we had candles lit and the cell phones were dead and computers were dead. So I ended up just strumming guitars a lot. So a few songs, the song Last Night on Earth and Blacked Out, which is a little bit more obviously related to not having any electricity at your house. And, you know, in the evenings, walking around on the streets was really eerie and had this kind of science fiction-y quality. There were no lights coming out from windows or no lights on the street. There was no power in Lower Manhattan, so it was pitch black and really weird. And you'd be walking on the streets and all of a sudden, like, figures would loom out of the shadows and stuff. And it had this weird post-apocalyptic kind of vibe to it.
The last night on earth, the last thing we wanted was to see the sunrise.
And I mean, as bad a situation as being sort of cut off from the world, like you say, your cell phone being dead and there being no power and stuff, I want to phrase this the right way, but was it kind of a little bit of a treat almost in this permanently interconnected, emailed up world? Was it maybe a little bit refreshing to just be put back in real life a little bit more for, you know, that probably quite dreadful 24 hours or so?
Well, it was 7 or 8 days. It was very, very interesting. It was a little bit of a treat. You know, the thing that was weird about it was, you know, no matter what plans anybody had, they all just were put aside all of a sudden. You couldn't do much. I mean, pretty much every day, you know, everyone you knew was out on the street with like their cell phone and the charging cables and their computer and the charging cables, like searching for somebody that had power so you could sit there for an hour or two and charge your stuff up and then, you know, take it home and use it till it died again. And my family, you know, we were just kind of hanging out. There wasn't much to do. You know, you were sitting around a table with candles and talking or playing a game of chess or something like that. It's interesting, those kind of enforced moments of, you know, of downtime, in a sense.
Some of the songs on the new album, it might occasionally feel that there's a slightly more classic songwriter vibe, but then some of them are still, you know, like 12-minute epics and stuff like that.
I knew that since I felt more confident in the musical abilities of the band, I wanted some of the songs to have more open, free sections where the band could, you know, just play and like maybe not know what was going to come next. You know, is it going to go wild and crazy, or is it going to go smooth and cool? Or, you know, it keeps the band on their toes in a certain way. It's really fun to feel like, you know, there's sections where you don't really know what's going to happen live, you know, and it makes it very exciting in a way.
It always seems to me that the kind of long sections in Sonic Youth songs are always controlled chaos, you know, like something sort of uncontrolled, yet you're working towards this goal together, so it doesn't stray into like indulgence, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'd always I always used to liken it to, you know, we'd have signposts in those sections. You know, you were starting at point A and you were going to end up at point F, and maybe there were a couple points to hit in the middle, but in between, you know, you could go whatever meandering course you chose to get there.
That was Lee Rinaldo speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, it's Christmas time and a special Christmas show, so we'll be looking at the seasonal ad campaigns airing around the world and visiting some of our favourite record stores to hear what's going to be flying off the shelves over the festive period. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher popped the whole thing in her magic radio oven at Gas Mark 7. That's hot. Thanks, Holly. Time for one final song this week from our album of the week, Tom Moulton's Philly Regrooved 3. Here he is with his take on Hold Back the Night by the Tramps. Thanks for tuning in.